It looks like everybody's settled. So with that, I will call the second case, which is Anderson versus Aiken Pharmacy Services, LLC. Case numbers A23-0374 and A23-0484. Good morning, counsel. As I believe you all know, you will each be given 15 minutes for your argument, and appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondents, I believe that you submitted correspondence about how you are planning to divide your time, and that's 10 minutes for counsel for Mr. Is it Bedeau?
Yes.
Okay. And then the additional 5 minutes for Aiken Pharmacy. Is that the plan?
Correct.
Great. So with that, counsel for appellant, if you'd like to approach the podium, you can begin. And if you would please begin by identifying yourself and your client for the audio record, we would appreciate it.
Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jess Braverman, and I, along with my co-counsel, represent Andrea Anderson in her sex discrimination claims against Thrifty White. Ms. Anderson is the appellant in this case. Ms. Anderson is entitled to judgment as a matter of law on her sex discrimination claims because, first, Thrifty White adopted a policy that on its face singles out customers by their protected status, and second, Thrifty White applied that policy to Ms. Anderson, denying her full and equal access to goods and services. Respondents forfeited any constitutional defenses in this case. As a matter of law, respondents violated the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and they are responsible for the harm they caused to Ms. Anderson. There are two legal issues that are crucial to getting this case right. They're issues that the district court got wrong and that defendants are urging this court to get wrong as well. Those two crucial issues are, first, the proper definition of discriminatory motive or discriminatory intent, and second, whether a policy singling out emergency contraception is disparate treatment based on sex under Minnesota law. So I'm going to start with the discriminatory motive question.
Ms. Braverman, before you do that, how long was the trial?
The trial was, I believe it was roughly a week.
So 5 days, roughly, of testimony and argument, I assume, and maybe some motions, and it looks like there's a lot of motions.
Yes.
Okay. But my question is this, considering the standard that we use, that I'm looking at the Vermillion case, that no reasonable theory supports the verdict, and the evidence must be so overwhelming on one side that reasonable minds cannot differ as to the proper outcome. And when I look at the briefing and the amici, we've got 38 at least different viewpoints on how to apply the discrimination law to the facts of this case. And including the two points that you just now highlighted. My question is this. It looks to me like from the record of the trial that all these same arguments that we're hearing were presented to the jury, and other than the legal arguments, some of the legal arguments were to the judge. My point being is that what was done, what your client had to do to travel to get the prescription and during the snowstorm, and why the pharmacist refused this particular, and all the explanation was given. And so basically everything was laid out. And so what's your best number one argument that we should determine those jurors were unreasonable?
The policy on its face, even viewed in the light most favorable to Thrifty White, so let's say there's no dispute, we're just going to take their best version, is that Mr. Bedeau could continue to refuse to dispense emergency contraception to women. If he was working and a woman came in with a prescription, he could contact another pharmacist to see if they could come in later or the next day. EC is emergency contraception is time sensitive. A woman with an EC prescription could not get her medication even if it's right there in the store, and she is the only one subject to that policy. That is Mr. Hutera's version of the policy. The only factual dispute is whether that policy did require Mr. Bedeau to call for backup. For JMOL, we don't need to worry about that. We'll assume that it did.
But one of the questions they were asked is whether there was a denial of full and equal employment of goods, services, facilities. And I understand your argument on the instruction. But again, given that burden, if they answer no to that question, that seems like that ends. And again, all these facts were laid out.
The question is whether it's reasonable to answer no when what happened to Ms. Anderson is she was singled out and had to drive 100 miles round trip in the snow.
That's kind of why I framed my question the way I did, is they were given that information, they were given all that evidence, and yet they said no, and you're asking us to say, no, you jurors, that was an unreasonable answer.
Well, the instructions were so far gone in this case, the jury was instructed not to attribute the actions of Mr. Badeau to the pharmacy, even though he was the chief pharmacist. They were told to consider whether there was a tangible change in conditions, which I think the Supreme Court is about to say doesn't even apply in the Title VII context. Full and equal in Minnesota means full and equal. There is no way to view the evidence in this case and find that she was not denied full and equal services. It's not a subjective question when someone is singled out and as a result of that has to travel 100 miles round trip in the snow. It's not, was that bad enough? It's, was that full and equal? And it was not. She was the only one singled out.
Go ahead.
I'd like to focus a little bit on the language of the statutes that are at issue in this case, the public accommodation claim and the business discrimination claim. Both reference that it is unfair discriminatory practice to deny, the public accommodations claim is to deny a person full and equal enjoyment, and I'm skipping ahead here, of services because of sex. And similarly, the business discrimination statute provides that it's unfair discriminatory practice to intentionally refuse to do business with a person because of the person's sex. And sex is defined for purposes of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to include, but it includes but is not limited to pregnancy.
Correct.
So what I'd like to first talk about with you is what is the meaning of pregnancy as used in that definition?
Absolutely, and thank you for that question. That was actually going to the second thing I was going to talk about. I'll make it first. Disparate treatment based on sex under Minnesota law. There are two federal cases that the Minnesota court has made clear have never been good law in our state, and those are Gilbert and Geduldig. Both of those cases involve exclusions for pregnancy-related benefits. In both of those cases, the court said that is not disparate treatment based on sex. You can bring a disparate impact claim, but not a disparate treatment claim. Two things happened after that ruling. Well, three things, but Minnesota led the way on this. The first thing that happened is in direct repudiation of Gilbert, Minnesota added pregnancy, childbirth, and disabilities related to pregnancy and childbirth to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The second thing that happened is that the Minnesota Supreme Court held that these were not new additions to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. They just clarify what has always been true. Under Minnesota law, it is illegal for a person's protected status to play a role in a discriminatory conduct. It cannot play a role. So what we need to ask then, okay, does emergency contraception cover this? The first thing I do is I direct the court to the case we cited, Erickson v. Bartell Drug Company, 141 F sub 2D 1266, which discusses emergency contraception denials in the context of Title VII. But let's just talk about the plain language of the statute. Emergency contraception delays ovulation. It's prescribed for one thing and one thing only: to prevent pregnancy, childbirth, and disabilities related to pregnancy and childbirth. Ms. Anderson was a mother and a foster mother, and when the condom broke, they decided they could not risk another pregnancy. Her first labor was medically complicated, long, and difficult.
Would you agree that pregnancy, the American Heritage Dictionary defines pregnancy as carrying developing offspring within the body. That pregnancy is the condition of carrying developing offspring within the body. And as I understand it, the emergency contraception in this case can work in one of two ways. One, it can prevent ovulation.
Correct.
And the other is it can prevent implantation of a fertilized egg. There's testimony.
Some people believe that to be true. It's prescribed to delay ovulation. There's different medication that's prescribed once implantation takes place, abortifacient, so mifepristone, misoprostol, but those are not at issue here. In Minnesota, in 2018, only physicians dispensed those medications, okay. Not pharmacists.
So in your view, does the is the discrimination here based on sex related to pregnancy or the ability to become pregnant?
That's correct, and I would refer the court to the Erickson case. The Minnesota Human Rights Act is intended to be interpreted broadly. So under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the question is, what is EC? It's emergency contraception. It is prescribed only for one thing, to prevent pregnancy. The court in the Erickson case did a really strong job of explaining why that is included under a definition of, you know, a discrimination based on pregnancy, childbirth, and disabilities related to pregnancy or childbirth. Prescription contraceptives, like other preventative drugs, help the recipient avoid the pregnancy, the childbirth, the disabilities related to pregnancy and childbirth. So pregnancy disability benefits doesn't refer to the pregnant employees, right? That was the 3M case. It refers to the benefits related to pregnancy. This is a medication that is only prescribed to prevent pregnancy. It serves no other purpose, and it is only prescribed to women. So the other thing that was important...
Well, and factually here, isn't Mr. Badeau's position that he thought that your client might be pregnant?
Well, yeah.
And that is the basis by which the refusal is happening, is because of his belief that a pregnancy, in fact, may have occurred.
Correct. He categorically presumed that every woman with an EC prescription was pregnant, and on that basis, he refused to provide it. But I think no matter what angle you come at this from, you come to the same conclusion. This was pregnancy-related discrimination. Whether it's because, as the court in 3M said, because only women need the pregnancy-related medical benefits, excluding pregnancy-related medical disabilities from an otherwise comprehensive income maintenance plan is per se sex discrimination. Whether it's because the medication is only used by women, whether it's because it's used to prevent pregnancy, whether it's because Mr. Badeau presumed that she was pregnant, all of these things lead you to the exact same place. The pregnancy, childbirth, and disabilities related to pregnancy and childbirth, it's not a limited, exhaustive list. It says including. And it's meant to repudiate Gilbert, where the court said that if a policy on its face doesn't mention men or women, but it singles out a medication only used by women, in Gilbert, that's disparate impact. In Minnesota, it is not. It is disparate treatment. That was the whole point of repudiating Gilbert, was to say, no, not in Minnesota. If it's a medication specifically used by women, targeting women, we're going to see it for what it is, and we're going to say it's disparate treatment based on sex. And that's the unequivocal ruling in the 3M case.
I guess my question is whether we even need to go that far in this case, going back to the plain language of the statute, whether we even need to go that far, or within the facts of this case, whether this is clearly about pregnancy, because that is precisely the reason why the medication was not offered.
No, the court does not need to go that far.
Dispensed.
I'm giving kind of a number of ways to get to the same conclusion, but it's inescapable. No matter what route you take, that's where you end up. But no, the court doesn't need to reach the, like, how does the medication work? What does it do? But in this case, that is the only thing this medication does. You might have another case where it's condoms or birth control that's not Plan B or Ella. I think the principle would be the same, but the court does not have to even get to that here.
Could you follow up with... am I correct? There was disputed evidence, just like you're arguing today, about what this prescription does.
It that doesn't change the outcome here. So no.
But I'm getting to the question of pregnancy or not. Am I correct that the testimony of the pharmacist was that that it can also have the effect of the ending a pregnancy, meaning whether one knows or not she's pregnant, it has that potential, and that would be the conscientious reason for denying it. But your client's evidence suggested no. It's consistent with what you're saying. It never gets to that point. So there's a conflicting evidence of what this prescription might do.
And I would say that's completely correct and completely irrelevant for the JMOL analysis.
Except if your client has the burden of proof, and it's based on pregnancy, wouldn't your client have to demonstrate she's pregnant?
No, that's the point of the 3M case. Disparate treatment based on medication specifically for women to, related to pregnancy is disparate treatment based on sex. That is what the 3M case did. It was a repudiation of the notion that denial of medications related to the reproductive system is a disparate impact issue and not a disparate treatment issue. It's disparate treatment under Minnesota law, and I would direct the court to the 3M case and the Erickson case. It lays that out really strongly, but it is disparate treatment under Minnesota law, not disparate impact. The other thing
Can we talk a little bit more about that? I know your time is short, but the Thrifty policy itself didn't preclude dispensing the prescription of Ella or emergency contraception.
It only applied to Ella, and it only applied to emergency contraception.
Right. The pharmacist Badeau, I think his testimony was that he refused to dispense it, but I think there's testimony in the record from the owner of the pharmacy that the pharmacy would make that prescription available through another pharmacist if possible. So how is the policy, Thrifty's policy, as opposed to what Badeau said, how is Thrifty's policy facially discriminatory where there are circumstances where the prescription could be dispensed to a woman at that store?
Two reasons. One,
I'm sorry. If for example, if the other pharmacist had, you know, the storm didn't happen and the pharmacist was there the next day, the other pharmacist he would have dispensed it.
Two reasons. First, Thrifty White is responsible for the actions of its chief pharmacist. He's a supervisor. He's the pharmacist in charge. That's the Freiler case. So as a matter of law, Thrifty White on the public accommodations discrimination claim is responsible for Mr. Badeau's behavior. The second issue is, what happened to Ms. Andrea when this policy was applied to her? Was she given full and equal service? Full and equal service would be ensuring that if she showed up the next day and the medication was in the store, she would get it. Mr. Badeau was calling her to tell her she could not be sure of that, and he meant it. He would not give it to her if he was there. That is not full and equal service. She is the only one who got that phone call that day, the only one. And if she showed up, he would not give her medication. It's time sensitive. If you ovulate before you take it, it does not work, and most people do not know when they ovulate. This is a time sensitive medication that he would not have given to her had she shown up. He told her this, and as a result, she had to drive 100 miles in the snow to get her medication, something no one else in that community had to do. And she would have had to do that even if the medication was in the store. That is not full and equal service. It cannot be. And so I know I had so much more. I know I'm out of time. So I would just wrap up and say, you know, Ms. Anderson respectfully requested this court enter judgment in her favor and remand for a trial on punitive damages and a judicial determination of costs and fees.
I have a couple of questions. I don't know if you...
Go ahead.
One of them is, did you request an agency instruction only on the public accommodation claim, or did you also ask for an agency instruction on the business discrimination claim?
We asked for an agency instruction. I believe it was both. I don't have that version of documents here, but in our original jury instruction requests, I believe we asked specifically that when the court used the word sex, when the court was instructing the jury on what the protected status was, that it was a patient in need of emergency contraception or something to that effect.
Which would have applied to both claims.
And we asked that it be a policy that it was either that they refused or that they had a policy of refusing. So that was in our requested agency instructions. So
as to both claims. I guess what I'm trying to target is your argument about the instruction regarding agency just targeted at your public accommodation claim, or is it also targeted at your business discrimination claim?
It's targeted at both. There were a bunch of different actions that took place. It was targeted at both, I would say. Yeah.
And then my second question regards the therapist-client privilege, which I know is kind of a little bit off the beaten path of the rest of this conversation, but I'm interested in what the rule of law is that you think that we should adopt with regard to therapist-client privilege when it comes to MHRA claims, because I do think that it's complicated for district court judges to figure out when is emotional when does emotional distress trigger this privilege and when does it not trigger this privilege? And so it would be helpful to me to know what rule of law you think we should adopt. And I'll have the same question for respondents if,
yes, you know. Thank you. I think that the rule should be that a plaintiff does not waive her privilege by simply bringing a Minnesota human rights case and arguing that she was stigmatized or embarrassed or ashamed by what happened and that it caused her to be anxious. I think she has to actually put her it's rule 35.03, put a mental or medical condition in controversy. Simply stating that someone is stressed or upset or stigmatized does not put a mental or medical condition in controversy. It would be more along the lines of someone claims they have PTSD, someone claims they have insomnia, someone's actually claiming a medical condition was caused or exacerbated by the incident. So where a patient alleges routine emotional harm from an incident, they're not putting their medical condition in controversy. I think it's right there in the law. I'm not sure exactly how to word it so that a district court will get it right in every case because it is a case-by-case determination. However, it would not apply simply because someone's seeking emotional damages under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. They have to be saying something more, such as it caused a medical condition or exacerbated a medical condition.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions?
I have one other question. You argued in your brief that the jury instruction on the word intentionally as used in the business discrimination claim was erroneous. And I'm wondering if you can tell me what you think the meaning of that word is as used in that claim and how that differs from the instruction, and finally, how your client was prejudiced by the instruction.
Yeah, so intent, adopting a policy allowing your pharmacist to turn women away, that's an intentional act. It's the intentional adoption of a facially discriminatory policy. That's all that's required. I would contrast that with intentional torts, where you're asking, let's say, did someone intend to cause emotional distress, right? Did you intend to cause that harm specifically? It's that definition of intent is unique to intentional torts, and it's never been applied in the human rights case. I think what happens when you use intent in that way is you start to put in a requirement that a defendant had animus or hostility or was somehow trying to harm the person. That's not an element of a discrimination claim. It's simply whether they denied the person full and equal access to goods and services. It doesn't matter if they did it to upset them, to harm them, to force someone to be pregnant. It doesn't matter why. It matters whether they did it. And here they did. And the adoption of a policy is intentional, and that's sufficient. And so I think the problem that happened here was that the court instructed the jury that if Mr. Bedeau or Thrifty White didn't intend to cause Ms. Anderson harm and stigma and shame, then they've not committed discrimination, and that is not the law in Minnesota. It's whether you intended to discriminate, which we have uncontroverted, no matter how you view the evidence, uncontroverted testimony of that here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach the podium. Please let us know your name and who your client and the client that you're representing.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rory Gray, and I represent respondent George Bedeau. May it please the court. Referring a prescription based on religious belief isn't status discrimination. That's what the jury found based on the following facts. The drug Ella wasn't in the pharmacy when Ms. Anderson requested it.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
I just turned 58 today, and my old ears are having trouble, so thank you.
The drug Ella wasn't in the pharmacy when Ms. Anderson requested it, so a tech placed it on the next day's order list. Mr. Bedeau kept it there. He wanted to find a win-win situation where Ms. Anderson got her prescription and he was excused. and that decision was based on the product and its function, not the person. Mr. Bedeau wouldn't personally fill that prescription for anyone. It's the jury's job to answer factual questions like motive. And here, the jury said there was
where
no
Where in the
sex
statute is motive? Where do you find motive in the language of the Minnesota Human Rights Act?
It's in the because of language, Your Honor. And Goins makes very clear that because of means he was actually motivated by a protected characteristic.
And which here, pregnancy is a protected characteristic in Minnesota?
Pregnancy, childbirth, and disabilities related to pregnancy or childbirth. But avoiding pregnancy and certainly ending pregnancy isn't the same as pregnancy. The Eighth Circuit explained
can
that.
Can we talk about what the word pregnancy means? You say avoiding pregnancy is not the same as pregnancy, but here, one definition of pregnancy is from the American Heritage Dictionary is carrying developing offspring within the body. And as I understand Mr. Bedeau's testimony, he thought there was could be a fertilized egg within Ms. Anderson's body. And that was the reason for his concern with dispensing this prescription.
Mr. Bedeau never expressed his objection as relating to any person in particular or their physical or medical condition. He is focused on the mechanism of action
but
of
he's
the
concerned
drug.
That there's a fertilized egg at issue, correct?
His concern is the effect on human life. So,
he has testimony about a concern about fertilized egg that you refer to in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
But my recollection of the testimony is that if it was just a medication for ovulation, he wouldn't have had the problem. It's the fact that there could be a fertilized egg is what created the problem.
The problem is the potential mechanism of action, which is the prevention of the fertilized egg implanting. So regular birth control, there's nothing in the FDA labeling that talks about preventing implantation. Ella is different. And that is why Mr. Bedeau had an objection. What he's
and
looking
so
at.
So the jury instructions noted that sex includes pregnancy and the ability to become pregnant. And so how is a concern relating to a fertilized egg not connected to pregnancy, or if it's not pregnancy, the ability to become pregnant and that egg whereby becoming pregnant, whereby that egg implants in the wall of the uterus?
Well, if we're talking about whether Ms. Anderson stated a sex discrimination claim, we've cited the dictionary definitions that say nothing about the ability to become pregnant. What they say is the fact of having a pregnant conditions, and that's what the Eighth Circuit looked at in
Union
Pacific Railroad.
But the jury instructions included the ability to become pregnant, and I don't. That isn't an issue here on appeal, right? You didn't argue in your brief, I don't think, that sex doesn't include the ability to become pregnant.
Well, Your Honor, our definition in our brief does not include that.
Well,
and
your
I would
definition
say
in your brief, I think, was
that this
point
court
me to
affirm.
The page in your brief, but I remember it was very limited. It was not very detailed. It was something to the effect that pregnancy is the condition of being pregnant.
Well, Your Honor, we were quoting the dictionary there, but this court can affirm on any basis supported by the record. I would point this court to Union Pacific Railroad, which is the Eighth Circuit decision that shows that avoiding pregnancy is not discrimination based on pregnancy.
Under what statute is Union?
That one is looking at the federal law, which is actually broader than Minnesota's wording. So if it doesn't count as pregnancy discrimination under the PDA, it doesn't count as pregnancy discrimination under the MHRA. So the important point here is that Mr. Bedeau was not focused on him or Ms. Anderson primarily. He was focused on a third party, and that's the life that's formed when an egg is fertilized, and you do DNA from the mother.
But the third party doesn't exist independent of a woman, correct?
Of course not, Your Honor. But the problem is that the MHRA is focused on motives, not consequences. Mr. Bedeau had to have a discriminatory motive. The jury found that he did not. And that's backed up by the statute, which does not impact so much what is done as to why it's done. Also,
Just so we're all clear, Mr. Bedeau did not raise a constitutional defense at the district court, correct?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, sorry. I apologize.
Mr. Bedeau's argument all along has been that there's no statutory violation here. And the district court pointed to and actually ruled on the constitutional issue as well, under both the state constitution and the federal constitution.
But so, he didn't argue if it is a violation, there's a constitutional exemption, that he has a constitutional protection.
He did not raise it as an affirmative defense. But under Thorpe, because the district court ruled on that issue, it's a fair issue for appeal. It's also very relevant to the constitutional avoidance doctrine, which is a standard method of statutory interpretation. And here, the jury found there was no sex discrimination, and this court should not overturn the jury's verdict under the very deferential standard of review, particularly here where Mr. Bedeau was
but
not
we don't
trying.
Need, I mean, to affirm, we don't need to reach sort of the broad question that you're raising, correct? I mean, it doesn't, I don't think, based on the instructions, as Judge Cochran was talking about, that the basis for the jury's verdict here was that sex cannot include this situation. This seems to me that you're asking us to look beyond the scope of what the jury did and find an alternative ground, as opposed to simply looking at the trial decision in this case. Because I don't think, as Judge Cochran pointed out, that this was that was the basis for the jury's factual findings in this case.
We're not asking this court to do that. I was just trying to address Judge Cochran's question about the language of the statute. So our position is that this court should affirm the jury's verdict because it heard 5 days of evidence that Mr. Bedeau was looking for a win-win, where Ms. Anderson got her prescription the day it was delivered, just not from him. That's not
an intent. Can I follow up with that? That was going to be my question. It follows up to actually Judge Larson's question. Again, given the burden and in the factual scenario, jury heard all this factual evidence that we're now talking about and writing about and thinking about. The question, no, that she was denied full and equal employment good services. Isn't that a necessary precursor to whether one discriminates, whether you call it facially or otherwise? If you're not denied services, it can't be a violation of MHRA.
Yes, Your Honor. What you're looking at is the public accommodation provision. Right. And it's important to recognize that Mr. Bedeau is not a place of public accommodation. He's a person. The pharmacy is the place of public accommodation. And the pharmacy did not deny Ms. Anderson anything. Mr. Bedeau hired intentionally a pharmacist who did not object to dispensing emergency contraception. He was supposed to be at the pharmacy when Ella arrived. Mr. Bedeau fully supported him filling Ms. Anderson's prescription. He just asked to be personally excused. And that's religious accommodation, not discrimination. And that's what the jury found. And that's backed up.
Can I ask you a question? In your brief, you argue that his decision, and I'm looking at, you know, the business discrimination claim against him, not the full and equal enjoyment claim, not the public accommodation claim, but in your brief, you argue that his decision was based on his religious beliefs and not Anderson's sex. Couldn't the two be intertwined, and maybe in this case, inextricably intertwined?
There are certainly situations where a protected characteristic and a religious belief are targeting the same thing. That's not this case. Mr. Bedeau is happy to serve women in general and pregnant women in particular. He would have provided Ms. Anderson with prenatal vitamins or any number of other drugs that would not have a potentially lethal effect. The point here is the impact on the third party, that fertilized egg that may be prevented from continuing life by implanting. That is what Mr. Bedeau is considering here, and the jury found that that was not sex discrimination. And that's backed up by Minnesota Statute 145.414A that recognized, the legislature says, that people should not be forced to accommodate or assist abortion. It's also backed up by the Minnesota Constitution, which provides very strong protections for conscience rights. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time has expired.
I saw that you have 50 seconds left, so are there any other questions? Seeing none, perhaps your co-counsel is going to get the fire of the questions at the end of the argument. Counsel, you may approach the podium.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Renelle Lear, and I represent respondent Aiken Pharmacy. First of all, I would like to address Judge Larson, your question about emotional damages, just to make sure that we get to that. Ms. Anderson, in this case, the only damages that she claimed were for emotional distress. That was the only monetary compensation that she was, compensatory damages that she was seeking. She tried to avoid having her mental health records produced by claiming she was only seeking garden variety damages. But that's not recognized in Minnesota law. The issue here was whether she put it, whether she wanted to award damages. So my answer to your question on what the standard should be is if a plaintiff is requesting damages based upon her mental health condition.
Is every claim of emotional distress, is that putting your mental health condition in issue?
Depending on what the claim is, if you are saying this impacted me in these ways, it does open up the door to your mental health records. If those are going to provide light on how it impacted your daily life, how you interacted with others, how you responded to the world, it does. The defendants are entitled to that information to test the veracity of the allegations. You should not just be able to rely on what the plaintiff testifies to.
So I guess, you know, what's the rule of law that you want us to adopt? So it wouldn't be as broad as anytime you allege emotional distress, the privilege is waived. So where is the line? Where is the line that would be drawn for district courts to help them figure out when it's appropriate to waive this privilege?
My proposal is that the line should be drawn when this plaintiff is seeking explicit damages based upon emotional distress.
Thank you.
I would also like to address the district court's instructions to the jury. So to answer your question, this was a 5-day jury trial. The jury deliberated for over 9 hours. In order to overturn that jury verdict, the court needs to find that they did not it's a high burden in order to overturn that decision, and I don't think that burden has been met here. With regard to the jury instructions, particularly the multiple defendants instructions and the agency employer-employee instructions, I'll address those first. On the multiple defendant instruction, that was a boilerplate instruction. It was taken directly from the jigs, and the appellant herself requested it. So the court properly exercised its discretion in providing that instruction. Also, with regard to the court's decision not to issue an instruction specifically setting out the employer-employee, there was no dispute that George Bedeau was acting in the scope of his employment. He was the pharmacist in charge.
But isn't that precisely why that instruction should have been given? If the evidence has been, aren't the appellants entitled to a jury instruction on the appropriate law? No one is disagreeing that agency law is relevant here. No one is disagreeing that Mr. Bedeau was an agent of Thrifty White. And so I guess I'm not understanding how the fact that we as lawyers understand how agency law works, and that's pretty straightforward. I don't think that the average everyday person necessarily understands the agency relationship. So I guess, can you help me understand why that instruction was not needed?
I don't believe it was needed here because of the testimony with regard to Mr. Badeau's relationship. Mr. Badeau's relationship, the fact that he was the pharmacist in charge.
But did Mr. Badeau testify, I am the agent of Thrifty White, and therefore my actions are the actions of the pharmacy? I don't know that that's how far the testimony went, which is what the instruction would have said.
I do not believe there was any testimony like that.
Wasn't there also in the closing by Thrifty a statement that the instruction says nothing about Badeau's actions being the actions of Thrifty White?
I believe that's accurate, and I believe that was an accurate statement of what the instructions themselves said.
But isn't that inconsistent with Badeau being an agent for Thrifty White?
I believe that
Aiken Pharmacy. How should we refer to the pharmacy?
It is Aiken Pharmacy.
Okay, Aiken Pharmacy, excuse me.
But you're correct. It's been referred to as both throughout this case. With regard to your question, though, Aiken, the argument of counsel is not testimony, and the jury was instructed on that. And I think it's also helpful to look at the jury's findings on the aiding and abetting claims to find that there was no prejudice here. Even if that instruction should have been issued, there was no prejudice here because of the jury's decisions on the aiding and abetting claim. You know, those claims essentially say that the jury was to determine whether George Badeau either intentionally aided or abetted Thrifty White to engage in public accommodations or business discrimination, also attempted to aid. The jury answered no on all of those questions. So I think that informs the jury's thinking that there was, even with that agency relationship, Mr. Badeau's actions did not rise to the level of discrimination. And I see my time is up.
I have a couple of questions, but would you?
I do too. You
okay. I guess one of my questions is, you rely on the non-precedential Rumble decision from the District of Minnesota, but I believe that Rumble cites to Title VII claims, and my understanding in terms of the analogies drawn between Minnesota law and federal law is that the public accommodation is more akin to a Title II claim as opposed to a Title VII claim. Do you have any federal cases where the same language about material disadvantage has been applied in the Title II context as opposed to the Title VII context?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. But I would say that Minnesota courts, in interpreting the provisions of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, they look at the interpretation the courts have on other provisions and the definitions of material disadvantage, tangible change in conditions have been used by the Minnesota courts in other cases.
But in employment discrimination cases, right? Because the distinction that they're trying to make is this is a public accommodation claim. This isn't an employment discrimination claim. And so when I was looking at the cases that were cited, they all seemed to be federal employment discrimination claims as opposed to federal public accommodation claims. And so it's not clear to me from what's been cited in the briefs whether federally under Title II they've adopted a similar limitation, because that would seem more analogous to Minnesota's public accommodation law.
I am not aware of cases that address that.
Okay, thank you. And then I also was wondering if you wanted to speak briefly about the application of the McDonnell-Douglas test, because my recollection of the McDonnell-Douglas test is that tends to apply to questions regarding circumstantial evidence as opposed to direct evidence of discrimination. And it seems to me that the appellants have alleged direct evidence of discrimination as opposed to a circumstantial evidence-based claim for discrimination. And I'm wondering if there are contexts where McDonnell Douglas has been applied for a direct evidence case?
My understanding, McDonnell Douglas is circumstantial evidence. But here, I don't believe there's direct evidence of discrimination. The circumstantial evidence is the policy. When you look at the policy that was in place at Thrifty White, Mr. Hutera wanted prescriptions filled at Thrifty White. That was his overarching goal. He did not want his customers to go somewhere else. That is why they implemented the policy that they would bring in another pharmacist, if at all possible, to fill the prescription. Ella is a drug that Thrifty White did not have in stock. Ms. Anderson's prescription was the only one at the time of trial ever that it had ever been asked to fill. It was not carried. They agreed to order the drug. It would have arrived at the pharmacy the next day if Ms. Anderson had left the prescription there. The other pharmacist, Mr. Grand, would have arrived at the pharmacy. The prescription would have been filled.
Judge Cochran?
Thank you. I have two questions for you. The first is, in your brief on page 13, you said the question for the jury was whether Aiken Pharmacy treated Ms. Anderson like others outside of the protected class when she faced with a prescription for a drug that the pharmacy did not have in stock. And so viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury verdict, was that standard met where Mr. Badeau told her he would not dispense Ella, but he would not have refused to dispense other drugs not in stock, such as an inhaler for asthma or an antibiotic?
I believe that the jury verdict was correct. In this case, the only reason that Mr. Badeau called Ms. Anderson was because it was a time-sensitive medication, and he knew that. He wanted to make sure she was able to get it. They didn't have it in stock, and that he would have called another customer with a different medication if he knew it was a time-sensitive medication and they didn't have it in stock. He would have given him the option of having another pharmacist fill it or transferring it to a different pharmacy.
Thank you. My other question relates to the 3M case, and appellants argue that this case is analogous, or I think that's what they're arguing. So if you could address that case, and if you think that case is distinguishable, if you can explain that.
I do think it's distinguishable. In 3M, the issue was whether the 3M benefits policies, what actual services that should cover. Here, and one of them was pregnancy. Here, the ability to become pregnant is not part of the statute. It's not part of the definition of sex under Minnesota Human Rights Act. I know what the jury instructions say. They include that within it. I don't know if that's a correct pronouncement of the law. We did not appeal it. That is not before the court right now. The jury was able to consider the ability to come pregnant as part of the definition of sex. And the jury's verdict on that was that Ms. Anderson was not discriminated against because of her sex.
Any other questions?
I did have a follow-up.
Okay.
From Judge Larson's question, if I understood your answer correctly to why McDonnell Douglas was appropriately applied and does apply in this case, was your answer because the policy, which as I understand it was oral, it became written after, but that was not allowed, and I know that's one of the objections or issues raised, but the point being is that the policy in and of itself doesn't answer the discrimination question directly, the evidence, and that's because it on its face, it would, it doesn't get to what the statute prohibits. That's where the evidence factually had to come in, which included the pharmacist's reason for denying that particular prescription.
That's correct, Your Honor. On its face, the policy is not facially discriminatory. It's a circumstantial case. You need to see how the policy is applied.
Thank you.
I see no further questions. So you handled the after argument question. So as the second attorney. So thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Appellant, you have 5 minutes or maybe more for...
Well, just really briefly on the McDonnell-Douglas question, a proper application of McDonnell-Douglas should not change the outcome in this case. It doesn't apply here. McDonnell-Douglas is just a windy road to get to the same conclusion. It's only used when you don't know whether a protected characteristic played a role in the discrimination. Here, there is no dispute. The only reason Ms. Anderson was singled out was because of what her prescription was for emergency contraception.
Can I ask a question about the policy issue?
Yep.
So I think it's that there's this 1999 guidance. Can you just clarify for me how the oral policy taken in the light most favorable to respondents is inconsistent with the 1999 guidance? And then could you second answer if the policy had been fully consistent with the 1999 guidance, would we be in the same spot?
Thank you for that question. The 1999 guidance requires pharmacies and pharmacists to make plans ahead of time in order to ensure that patients get their time-sensitive medication immediately. The reason for that is that emergency contraception is a time-sensitive medication. If you ovulate before you take it, it does not work. And so everyone needs to take it as soon as possible. The 1999 provision requires the pharmacy to plan ahead. It requires them to make arrangements with other pharmacies and to make arrangements with other pharmacists. Neither of those happened here. The policy, even in the viewing it in the light most favorable to Thrifty White, did not involve making any arrangements with other pharmacies. Patients were left on their own to go find a place willing to serve them. And in rural Minnesota, where Ms. Anderson lived, that was 100 miles away. Or 100 miles round trip, excuse me.
Was there testimony from Mr. Bedeau that had your client not hung up the phone, he would have helped her find another pharmacy?
He stated that. I would say, you know, I don't, for the purposes of judgment as a matter of law, let's just assume that were true. I think even if that were true, it wouldn't change the outcome here. Because public accommodations are required to be full and equal services, full and equal. It's not that you can't deny, because the whole thing with public accommodations is that it's the stigma of being turned away. That's why in the Potter case, where the gym had a work out or leave policy, and the gym was found liable for discrimination, there was $0 of emotional harm, but $1,000 of punitive damages. And the gym said, hey, isn't this trivial? Why are we being liable? And the court said, the discrimination is the harm. And that's what happened here. Mr. Bedeau called Ms. Anderson, singled her out for a phone call, told her he morally disagreed with her medication. She was shamed and embarrassed and had to go elsewhere. That is the exact thing that public accommodations provisions are designed to address.
But this is, so I guess this was the second part of my question, though, is even if they had complied, I mean, based on your interpretation, even if they had complied with 1999, wouldn't your client still have been told she needed to go somewhere else?
Yes, I think that it's possible for... I think there are situations where a pharmacy can comply with this and it has no effect on the patient. Like if you go to a pharmacy, there's two pharmacists working. One takes the prescription and is like, oh, yes, of course, hands it off to someone else who gives it to the patient. She'll never know, right? Like there's no stigma there. She just doesn't know what's even happening. It's seamless. But if you're sending patients to other pharmacies, if you're sending them on a 100-mile trek to get their medication and they're the only ones subject to that and it's time-sensitive, then that is a violation of the public accommodations provision.
So even if they had applied the 1999 guidance where they had planned ahead with another pharmacy that could have dispensed this medication, it's under your... Under your interpretation of the statute, that could still be discrimination.
Absolutely.
The
guidance isn't an interpretation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. It's basically because pharmacists have to dispense all medications, it's the pharmacy board came up with this guidance to to make sure people are getting their medication on time, right? The pharmacy board's concern is public health. And so not giving people their medication is a public health concern. In Ms. Anderson's case, her becoming pregnant and having another labor was a medically complicated and scary proposition for her. That is why emergency contraception has to be provided immediately. But I don't know, what they could have done is not, there are a lot of things they could have done, right? They could have not had Mr. Bedeau working alone. They could have not allowed him to call clients and tell them, I morally disagree with what you're doing. That's the exact type of stigmatic harm that public accommodations provisions are designed to address. There are a lot of different things that could have happened here that I think would have still put them in compliance. If accommodating his religious beliefs is impossible for them, then that is what it is. It's unfortunate. But I think he can work as a pharmacist in a place where he's not turning people away and forcing them to go 100 miles round trip in the snow. What we can't do here is confuse the whether the policy is discriminatory with why the policy was put in place, right? That's why in cases where people have religious objections, they raise constitutional challenges, because the religious objections would put them out of compliance with the statute. And so they need an exemption. And so I'm just asking that this court not confuse the whether with the why. Ms. Anderson was subject to the exact stigmatic harm that the policy is intended to prevent. There was no constitutional exemption raised here. Had they raised it, it would have been litigated. That's
how do you respond to the argument that the district court put it in issue by deciding the issue in response to your motion for judgment as a matter of law?
The court confused the whether with the why. The court confused the question of
but I guess for the purpose of us considering the issue, does that make it a live controversy for us to resolve the constitutional question?
It does not, for a few reasons. First, there was no fact development. The constitutional issues in this case are whether the law was narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling government interest. There was no fact development on any of those questions because the issue wasn't raised, so the court wasn't actually addressing a relevant factual record. The second reason is that the Attorney General wasn't notified. The government has demonstrated that it has an active interest in this case, and where the Attorney General is not notified, the Court of Appeals does not address the issue, where it's raised by the defendants for the first time on appeal. And I'll point the court to the Charbonneau case and the La Liberté case that the Attorney General cited in their briefs, where defendants raise a constitutional claim for the first time on appeal, and the government did not have a chance to weigh in, and there was no fact development.
Can I ask you on that? Does one need to raise a constitutional issue if one simply has a defense, a general defense, not an affirmative defense, to whether they discriminated by their conduct? And here, as pointed out in one of the respondents' arguments, and it looks like in the briefs, there was no dispute from the beginning, and maybe even in the phone call all the way forward, that he had a religious basis upon which not to prescribe. And so that was consistent. Everybody knew about it. There was no surprises. And only now is it raised. Of course, the judge did make reference to it, but he wasn't prevented from raising it. It would have been raised, I suspect, if the jury instructions had been different, or if he had been prohibited from explaining his religious belief.
He needed to raise it. What they're saying is why they adopted a facially discriminatory policy. The question of why is not relevant here.
I didn't read it that way, but I understand your explanation. Isn't there a right for one who's been alleged to have committed something, a violation of the MHRA, to explain that it was not because of sex, no, it was because of?
No, so this is confusing the whether and the why. And so this is a really important point that I wanted to make at the beginning. What is a discriminatory motive, right? So I'd point the court to the Newman versus Piggy Park case. In that case, a restaurant refused to seat black customers because of the restaurant owner's sincere religious beliefs. No one questioned whether those religious beliefs were sincere, but that went to the question of why they had the policy in place, not what the policy was.
So you're going back, though, the discussion of whether it's direct versus indirect or facial versus not.
Well, what they did to Ms. Anderson, they did because she had an EC prescription. There is no other way to look at the evidence in this case. The question of why they did it, this isn't an employment case, right? It's not a BFOQ. There's nothing here to trigger that being relevant to the analysis. In addition, in order to raise a constitutional claim, they have to actually raise it. It's not the same analysis, right? If you look at 303 Creative, Hobby Lobby, Masterpiece Cake Shop, right? All of those cases were constitutional claims that involved looking at completely different issues from the question of liability. And that's because they were raised by the people who wanted to discriminate. They were breaking the law because of their religion. They asked for an exemption, and that's what defendant was required to do here. There is no question that he broke the law. It's, you cannot refuse, you cannot turn customers away based on a protected status. Even if the reason you're doing that is your religious beliefs, you have to seek a constitutional exemption, and they did not do that here.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you to the council. Thank you for your excellent briefing in this matter and for your arguments today. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the time prescribed by statute.
Thank you.